This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Yes means yes, and no means no. It seems like a simple concept, but everyday people struggle with it when it enters the realm of sexual consent. When does a yes turn into a no? And what happens to that yes when the conditions change? Now, this probably goes without saying, but this conversation will include open and honest talk about sex. Nothing filthy, but very frank. So if you would rather listen to this later, away from the kids, for example, you'll find the entire program online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter A. org. Joining me in studio for the conversation is Alexandra Brodsky. She's a fellow at the National Women's Law Center and the co-founder of Know Your Nine. Alexandra, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Kristen Hauser, the Chief Public Affairs Officer for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. She joins us from WYEP in Pittsburgh. Kristen, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Joining us from Los Angeles is Jackson Katz, the co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention. He's a president of MVP Strategies and the author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. Jackson, glad to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Joshua.
And joining us from NPR in New York is Shelby Chestnut, the director of community organizing and public advocacy for the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Welcome, Shelby.
Thank you for having me.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about dealing with issues of sexual consent and improving the ways in which we clarify intent and consent. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Alexandra Brodsky, let me start with you. What is one thing you find in your work that people think they know about consent, but they really don't?
I think that often people think of consent as a light switch. So they think that you've turned it on and anything that happens after that point is A-okay. But I think that what's really important is that consent has to be an ongoing conversation. So I have recently published a paper about non-consensual condom removal, where two people start having sex with a condom, and one of the partners removes the condom without the other person's permission. And, you know, intuitively, we can all tell that's not the sex that the person agreed to, and that's not okay.
This has come to be known as stealthing.
That's the term that people who encourage each other to engage in this practice use. And I can't believe that that is a community of people. But in my research, I actually found message boards where men encouraged each other to take off condoms and gave each other tips about how to do it without getting caught.
So as I'm glad you bring this up. So as we go forward in this conversation, I want to be clear that stealthing is, you're viewing this as kind of a euphemism among people who maybe don't take this as seriously as they should.
Yeah, I think it sounds kind of like a trend, a weird thing that the kids are doing these days, and it's a form of violence.
Kristen Hauser, what about you? What do you find is one thing people think they know about consent but really don't?
People seem to be very focused on like the no means no concept, and similar to what Alexander was saying, really are not paying attention that a good sexual experience involves two people that are mutually enthusiastically engaged on what is going on at all times. And we really need to be setting different standards to help people recognize and learn different ways to check in. So if somebody is suddenly not seeming to enjoy themselves, not participating, not, you know, mentally present anymore, it's okay to check in and change things, but that this is not a one-time negotiation.
Kristen, what does the law actually say in terms of consent? Is there a legal definition, or is this just kind of that thing that we cobble together from cultural norms and case law? Is it clear?
It's not universally clear if we're talking about what the law is in the United States, because each state has their own laws about what constitutes sexual assault. There is consistency, certainly, that when there is force or threat of force used, or if a person is unable to consent due to being incapacitated or having mental or emotional insufficiencies that would make giving consent difficult or impossible to do, then we tend to codify sexual actions that fall under those circumstances as crimes. But I think that right there is part of the problem. Our culture is very focused on what is criminal. And the law takes a while to catch up with the different ways that people are coming up with to harm and exploit one another. And if you look at sexual violence along a continuum, there are many things that are abusive and exploitive and promote power imbalances, but that are not criminal. And we need to be addressing those things and shifting our cultural acceptance of them if we're going to be able to effectively help people recognize that just like the things that are described as criminal are truly the most egregious of the things going on in our culture, but they're not the only things we need to be concerned about.
Jackson Katz, what do you think of how we deal with these issues of consent as it relates to the role of men in sexual encounters that go wrong? Now, I understand, and I want to be clear, we don't want to structure this as too much of a heteronormative conversation because these consent issues come up among LGBT people, and we will talk about that and we can talk about that. But if we just focus for the moment on more heteronormative pairings, what do you think is the role of men in this whole conversation?
Well, I mean, I think men are the ones who are committing the overwhelming number of acts of non-consensual sex, whether it's rape or stealthing or whatever form of non-consensual sexual coercive behavior. It's men who are committing the vast majority of it. Men are sometimes the victims of it as well, but men are overwhelmingly the perpetrators. So I think men need to be part of the conversation, and we need to be talking about the social norms in male culture or in the larger culture that are shaping boys and men's, in this case, heterosexual boys and men's understandings of their own sexuality and their own entitlement in a certain way to women's bodies, and the porn culture, the media culture that shapes and helps to shape norms. All of that has to be under the critical spotlight, because I think it'd be naive to think that we're talking about individual acts of aggressive behavior or non-consensual sexual aggression, that it's somehow disconnected from these larger social norms. I think that's naive. So I think the role that men need to play are on many different levels is both in dialogue, both being educated, but those of us who are men in positions of institutional and cultural leadership and influence with young men as well as other men need to be engaged in active conversations about what it means to treat others with respect and dignity in a sexual sense. What is the difference between healthy sexuality in a heterosexual or non-heterosexual context and those forms of sexuality that are presented to boys and men largely through media and pornography and such that are unhealthy and in many cases abusive?
Any one particular source of the culture, Jackson, you think where this is the most pernicious that we should address first?
Well, I mean, porn culture. I mean, I think that the primary socialization, sexual socialization of boys in our society and young men is pornography. And the pornography industry is filled with a sort of a sexualization and eroticization of non-consensual sexual interaction. And, you know, like Kristen was saying about the, you know, sort of healthy heterosexual or non-heterosexual sex involves mutuality and mutual pleasure and mutual respect. In the mainstream of the pornography industry that's marketed to young men, there's no mutuality. It's men are acting upon women, and when women say no, they don't really mean no.
Right.
They're just teasing. And again, I don't mean to overstate this. I think it's incredibly important that we be having honest and open conversations. If in the absence of sex education, in the absence of open dialogue, mm-hmm. the porn industry has really shaped a whole generation or two or three of young men's understanding of their and women's sexuality.
Reed wrote us via email, one more area where women are subjugated, not just to the will of a frat boy, but also to the will of a male-dominated judicial system. We still have a long way to go before women can feel comfortable standing up to that system. I do want to talk more about that and about how all people, not just women, but everyone who is on any end of sexual consent deals with this as we continue our conversation with Alexandra Brodsky of the National Women's Law Center, Kristen Hauser of the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, Jackson Katz, the co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention, and Shelby Chestnut of the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Shelby, let me ask you about how these conversations play out among LGBT people. What do you find the conversation centers on these days, and where do you find is the most effective in answering these questions of consent among LGBT people?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think first you have to understand that, like you've pointed out, LGBT people are oftentimes left out of the conversation around consent or sexual violence. Society as a whole has continually gendered the ways in which people are experiencing violence, that a woman is a survivor and a male is a perpetrator. And I think LGBT people are sort of flipping that on its head and saying, no, we're all sort of victims and perpetrators, and it doesn't need to be gendered. I think what ends up happening, though, is that LGBT people at very young ages start to delegitimate their experiences that they may be having as it relates to violence because they don't hear themselves reflected in language and in services and in just the larger conversation around consent. Certainly, I think there's been immense progress in the last decade around young people talking about the impacts of sexual violence and the need for consent in all areas of their life, and have done immense work to sort of ensure that LGBT people are part of that conversation. But I think the historic sort of roots of how we talk about sexual violence and consent remains very gendered in a number of ways, to the fact that, you know, there's very limited data on the prevalency rates of sexual violence among LGBT people. We have very limited information on bisexual women and some information on transgender women. Mm-hmm. But again, we're completely leaving out male survivors of sexual violence in much of the research that exists.
How much do you think that social media and technology factor into the way that LGBT people deal with issues of consent? There are a number of apps now that are geared, for instance, specifically to gay men to hook up or to meet. How does that factor into the way we discuss consent?
I mean, I think if anything, it's forced us to challenge the ways that we're thinking about consent and how we sort of promote consent in society. I know that there's been a number of LGBT organizations, the New York City Anti-Violence Project included, who have really made efforts to reach sort of the online dating and hookup app community and advertise our services, that we have a 24-hour hotline and, you know, what consent looks like to people, so that if they do have negative encounters when using an app, that they can reach resources and have their needs addressed.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. We asked our listeners to share their stories and their thoughts about the gray areas of consent, and a number of our listeners shared some really powerful stories, including this one that a listener left in our inbox.
My name is Alma. I live in Kansas. My father repeatedly raped my mother. It was so bad, the priest even told her to divorce him. Growing up, I was then sexually assaulted, never raped, but sexually assaulted. I have four daughters. Every one of my four daughters has been date raped. When they get the opportunity to confront the person, those guys are always so confused. They don't think they did anything wrong. It's a culture. We have to break it, and I'm glad you're talking about it. For my mother, she was taught she had no right. It was normal. She had to have sex whether she wanted to or not, and he had the right. He didn't have the right, and it was a horrible experience growing up, and it pervades through everything. Thank you.
Alma, I'm really heartbroken to hear about what happened to your four daughters, but I think it's great that their mom is brave enough to talk about this. So thank you for sharing that story. Alexandra, what do you think was the turning point where stories like what Alma shared began to change and people began to think of consent in a different way? What sparked the change?
You know, I think it's been a really long process, and I am so grateful for so many people who have spoken out at serious personal cost. And I think that that goes back to, you know, Anita Hill talking about her experiences being harassed by Clarence Thomas, both to put sexual harassment on the radar and to create a model for other people to talk about their experiences publicly and to reject the shame that they are told that they should feel for being victimized. You know, I think that a couple of years ago, we started seeing students on college campuses speaking out. Angie Epifano at Amherst wrote a really powerful narrative of her experience being raped in college. And I remember I, at that point, had just graduated from college myself. And it had been literally unthinkable when I was a student that someone would do that someone would be brave enough and strong enough to put themselves out there for the cause. So I'm so thankful for that.
Let's see. So many interesting comments about this. It's kind of hard to pick which one we should talk about. Although Randy's comment about technology is a good one. Let's Randy wrote us via email. Not to sound like my granddad, but it seems to me it's only compounded by the millennial Tinder hookup culture. Because you know who doesn't have to worry about consent issues? People who don't expect to have sex on a first date and instead actually date to get to know someone before you take that next step. Alexandra, I see you shaking your head in horror at that. Why?
Look, Tinder didn't invent sexual violence. We know that people within relationships have long victimized each other, and for years and years with impunity. You know, it was just a couple decades ago that most of the country, a man, and this is how the law was set out, a man could legally rape his wife, and that was fine. And I actually think that Tinder and other kinds of online dating apps create an opportunity for more frank discussion of sexual violence, to give people the tools to flip the script and be honest about what they want in sexual encounters and be open and communicative. And I think that that can only lead to safer and better sex.
We got to pause in just a moment, but Jackson Katz, I wonder what you make of Randy's comment that the impact of what he calls the millennial Tinder hookup culture maybe raises the possibility or increases the possibility that there could be this problem with consent.
Well, I think all of us who are educators in dealing with issues of sexual violence, sexual coercion, sexual harassment, have to engage with the complex new social interactions that are made possible by the new technologies of communication. And so it's one thing that, as an educator, that I think is frustrating, but, you know, potentially hopeful to Alexandra's sentiment, is that both yes, new forms of abuse are possible through these technologies, but also new forms of resistance to abuse and education. But I think that we're way behind in schools, for example, high schools, certainly. The status quo of most education around image-based abuse, sexual abuse, or, you know, social media and technology-related sexual abuse of various kinds, the frame is generally a law enforcement frame where people are told by, like, an assistant district attorney, where students are given a lecture about the, you know, cyberbullying and the criminal aspects of these kinds of behaviors, and how if you don't have consent, then you're committing a crime.
Right, right.
While I appreciate people need to know the law, I think that we need to integrate this into the educational practice much more organically than just seeing it as a criminal justice issue. And we need to see it as both an educational opportunity, a social justice issue, and a basic respect issue.
Well, we'll talk more about how to do that as soon as we're done taking this break. We'll continue this conversation on the other side and get to that point. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program about fighting terrorism. ISIS is claiming responsibility for that deadly bombing in Manchester, England. President Trump is pushing for the Muslim world to step up its fight against extremism. Drive them out, he said during his speech in Saudi Arabia on Sunday. But terrorism and extremism are based on ideas and beliefs. You might kill an attacker, but the ideas that motivated them live on in others. So we'd like to hear your questions about fighting extremist ideologies. What do you want to know? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. What questions do you have about fighting extremist ideologies? We'd especially welcome hearing about any experiences you may have had with this, either in anti-terror operations or maybe even in communities that are trying to prevent extremist groups from taking root. So tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212 and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We'll answer your questions and share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation about sexual consent with Alexandra Brodsky of the National Women's Law Center, Shelby Chestnut of the New York City Anti-Violence Project, Jackson Katz, the co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention, and Kristen Hauser of the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. We got a number of stories from people about dealing with those gray areas of consent, including some who expressed regret about the way they made their decisions, including this story that was left in our inbox.
Hi, this is John from Richmond, Virginia. When I was a teenager, I had a girlfriend who was very religious. She did not want to have sex. We talked about that, but neither of us had any idea about consent. It was not talked about at home. It was not taught in school. So one day after pushing for so long, I had eventually gotten a sure, let's just get it over with from her. Clearly not consent. I did not realize that at the time. We went on to have a fine emotional and sexual relationship afterwards, but that still sticks out as a terrible thing in my past. And I just wish that there had been more resources as a teenager to teach us about what consent really means, like what is okay and what's not.
John, thank you for sharing your story. Jackson Katz, I wonder what you say to young men who are dealing with these very primal urges, who may morally be okay with respecting their sexual partner's decision, but just emotionally, physically, might struggle with how to do it.
Well, again, I appreciate that was very brave of that young man to actually say that out loud. I think that he represents a lot of young men, and men not just young, who have felt like what they were doing was expected or normative or not somehow criminal, certainly in any way, but who have grown up in a culture where the normalization of certain kinds of coercive practices is pervasive. And one thing, Joshua, before I forget, I think Alexandra's article about this notion of stealthing and men taking off the condom and while having sex and continuing without the knowledge of their partner, et cetera, that's related to research that's been done for now 40 years by Joseph Pleck and others into men's and young men's condom use. And what are the factors that, for example, that prevent men and young men from using condoms, even when you would think that it was a rational act for prevention of sexually transmitted infections or HIV, but also pregnancy? And one thing that comes up over and over again in that research is that it's an ideology, it's a belief system about entitlement, about pleasure, about your needs being put first. Those are belief systems. Those aren't individual kind of idiosyncratic thoughts. These are belief systems that are much more normative. And so I think young men need to know, and men need to know that we're, and women, obviously, all of us need to know that the solutions to these problems are not just running from one individual case to the next, like whack-a-mole, and trying to figure out what went wrong, but trying to take a step back and ask the larger questions about how, as a society, and all of us are part of a system that produces and reproduces these same predictable problems.
Well, but Jackson, let's step back for a second. I'm a young man. I meet a woman. I'm interested in her physically. My hormones are at high tide, and you're asking me to think about consent? How do you teach a young man to do that?
Well, Joshua, I appreciate your point, but there's all kinds of ways in which young men who with all kinds of raging hormones and feelings learn very early on and are taught very early on how to control those feelings. There's a lot of young men who feel angry and aggressive that don't punch their, you know, coach in the face. They don't punch their teacher in the face. They don't push their father up against a wall or a locker when they're angry. The question is, why do they do that with their girlfriend? Why do some of those men and boys act in those ways towards their girlfriend when they wouldn't in other ways? It's because they've been taught that there are consequences, there are negative consequences, there is ways to control your emotions and your hormonal feelings, that it's not just that we're overcome by these urges that we can't control. That's part of the mythology, I think, that we have to counteract.
Kristen Hauser, what do you think? How do you teach a young person to put their hormones to the side for a moment and deal with consent rationally?
We really promote working with parents to talk about consent in age-appropriate ways from a very early time on. So you want to be working with your children when they're very young to give them proper names for body parts. Don't add shame to their experience of their bodies starting at a young age, and give them the language to talk about what's happening to them. You want to, as they're older, reinforce that they have the right to choose what happens to them. So at family gatherings, if you have an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent who's insisting on a hug or a kiss from the child and they don't want to, intervene on that child's behalf and suggest an alternative, a high five away from across the room, but something that reinforces that child has the right to make decisions about being touched and who they touch. When we start instilling norms of respect, kindness, empathy, and treating one another in healthy ways and talking through problems, You set a norm that this doesn't have to be only about sex. We're talking about setting these norms in a consistent, age-appropriate manner throughout a person's lifespan. When you do that, and that's the normal way that they're approaching decision-making points in their life, then we're taking away this idea that sex is somehow different or loaded or has special rules to it. If you're used to treating people with respect, and that makes you feel good because you know you're being a nice person in doing so. And most of us get rewards from other people around us when we treat them with kindness. So it's sort of a self-fulfilling practice to have. You know, you're going to end up with people who bring those same values into their sexual relationships. We need to start really fostering healthy sexuality because sexuality is with us birth to death. It right. is not something that, you know, we discover when we hit puberty, and that a one-time conversation with a parent is going to, you know, provide all the information you need. Mm-hmm. We are born being sexual beings. That's with us birth to death, and we need to start talking in our communities about that and have parents talk to one another about that.
Well, Shelby, I wonder about that. I mean, as it relates to young people and dealing with sexuality and trying to do it in a way that's affirming, I think it's maybe a challenge when you're young because you're just learning about expressing sexuality. You're learning how to flirt. You're learning how to read cues, especially if you're a young LGBT person who is newly out. You're beginning to claim your sexuality in a variety of ways, which can include being acknowledged or being comfortable in your skin. And I can see this very easily feeling like having to quarantine yourself off from people because you just don't know the lay of the land. Some of our listeners actually said that they have pulled way back in terms of waiting for an affirmative, outright, very clear yes, including this listener who left a note in our inbox.
This is Blake from Arkansas, and I'm an African-American student at one of the public universities in the state, and with issues of consent, I generally just keep my distance from them if there is not blatant consent. There are typically a lot of issues when it comes to black men and consent, and 9 times out of 10, it doesn't fare out well for the black men. So therefore, unless blatant consent is given, I keep my best to stay as distant as possible.
Blake, I appreciate you leaving the note. Shelby, how do you teach young people about the line between flirting, consent, how to navigate all this?
I mean, I think first of all is having an honest conversation throughout society and talking about sex and consent. I don't think as a whole we normalize sex, sexual activity, or consent at all throughout society. I think especially I'm heartened to see young people today talking about consent, and they truly have led some of the biggest charges around talking about consent on college campuses. I think one area that the country as a whole really needs to focus on is comprehensive sex education that's inclusive of LGBT people. You know, we're living in a society that has not done that for a number of years, and you see the impacts it has on people's lives, whether that's high rates of teen pregnancy, whether that's high rates of sexual violence, whether that's high rates of HIV contraction. You know, I think allowing young people to understand that they have the tools and adults sort of taking a step back and realizing that is really key in allowing young people who are LGBT, who are not, to really come into themselves. I think we underestimate how comfortable young people actually are in themselves and with their peers in figuring out the solutions to the problems that they're having.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. So let's end with some resources. First of all, let me just get a clear, you know, Alexandra, how about you just walk us through what you tell everybody in terms of consent? I'm a young person. I see somebody I'm interested in. I might want to make an overture. Walk me through this.
You know, we all learn in just our day-to-day lives outside the bedroom how to ask people about their preferences and how to read from their words, from their body language, you know, what they want. So it's not so hard to ask someone if they want to get coffee with you. And if they say no, or if they say, I don't know, maybe I'm busy, we know how to read that. And look, obviously, sex is more complicated because there are power dynamics that just aren't at play in asking someone to Starbucks usually. But I want to affirm the idea that young people have the tools that they need. I actually hear much more often from older people that wouldn't it be so complicated to try to figure out what your partner wants? And, you know, what young people say is, no, I do this all the time. So I have a lot of faith that with confidence, people can treat each other respectfully.
I should note that we've received a lot of stories from a lot of folks in our audience about having been assaulted and dealing with these gray areas of consent. We clearly don't have time to read through them all, but if I could just validate the fact that you chose to send your story to us, that you trusted us with that, thank you. You've been heard. We really appreciate your willingness to talk about these things. We also got a number of comments from our listeners, as we're running short on time in the hour, but we got a number of comments from listeners about where they've learned about consent. Quite a few of them have said that they've learned from people who are kinky, people who are into SM or who are swingers who have had to deal with issues of consent very directly. A lot of the people that I learned consent from were leather men, and they were out in the gay community after I came out because they've already had to own sex fully and learn how to navigate consent. Shelby Chestnut, who would you point to in terms of who societally is leading this conversation? Who is leading the way in terms of getting us to talk about sex in a way that's not purely clinical and that's not purely terrifying, that can be useful?
I would say survivors of violence around the country. You know, day after day, you hear these heroic stories, and, you know, you're seeing it on your show today, of people sharing their stories. And what that can mean for the survivor who may not know that they've experienced violence, who's cautious to share their story. Truly, these stories have impacts on people's lives and inform the ways that we think about policy and we think about advocacy and we think about resources. They're the true heroes in this situation.
Kristen Hauser, briefly, if someone thinks that they have been a victim of consent gone wrong, what should they do? Briefly.
Number one is taking care of yourself. And there are rape crisis centers and support centers across this nation, and every community has one. So we would encourage you to, you can get on our website, nsvrc.org, to look for them, or check out the National Sexual Assault Hotline to be able to reach out. I just want to add one other thing here. I want to be cautious that we're not confusion about consent with people that are choosing to commit acts of violence. So right. If people are worried about it, you know, just use that. As long as everybody's enthusiastically participating, there's really nothing, this doesn't need to be scary. We need to make that the standard that we are living and practicing.
And Jackson Katz, briefly, before we run out of time, I'm sure that there is a young man somewhere who's heard this conversation and is thinking, that's all well and good if you get caught. But if I do it discreetly, she'll never know. It doesn't really matter. I'm going to do this. I'm sorry. I'm a young man. And as long as I don't get caught, it's not a problem. To that young man who's on that edge, who may be hearing this, what would you say to him?
I mean, I would say that you're the only one that has to look yourself in the mirror in the morning. You know, who do you want to be in the world? Do you want to be a person who treats people with respect, who sees sex and other forms of pleasure as a mutual experience, or that you're just an exploitative person who wants to get what you can while you can? Because ultimately, no matter how much, you know, education somebody gets, or not, how much sort of the social norms in the broader culture shift, individuals do have to make choices. And I think I would ask that person to think about who they are and who they want to be, and act accordingly.
And Alexandra, for people who may have been victims of this, who may be thinking, no one's going to believe my story, no one's going to take my side, you know, they're going to think that I was being slutty, or I should have just said no, or it's my fault, there's no point in telling anybody. What would you say to them?
Telling someone about your story is a big step, and it's a hard one, and it takes serious trust. But I really hope that if you safely can turn to someone for help, that you do, because this isn't something that you should have to shoulder alone, and there are communities ready to support you, and we're thinking of you.
Well, we certainly appreciate all of you for being with us and talking about this tough subject. Alexandra Brodsky is a fellow at the National Women's Law Center and the co-founder of Know Your Nine. Alexandra, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Kristen Hauser, the Chief Public Affairs Officer for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Thanks, Kristen.
Thank you.
Jackson Katz, the co-founder of Mentors in Violence Prevention and the president of MVP Strategies and the author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. Thank you, Jackson.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Shelby Chestnut, the director of community organizing and public advocacy for the New York City Anti-Violence Project. Thank you, Shelby.
Thank you.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with this NPR member station for more coverage of the Manchester attack. This is 1A.